I see it in two ways here at this point as well. I mean, I feel that this could be something external, obviously, that's very interesting. But I also think that, again, there's a connection with the inner world, the inner the psyche, that this could actually be demons in a way that are actually coming out, or, you know, archetypes almost, if you will, that this is something inherent, something within a person that they haven't dealt with, that is coming out, and consequently is playing out their role in the world or what have you. It might be some kind of processing that is going on. It's very much, I don't know how things are in you know, more, you know, Eastern countries and so forth, but this thing just with the alcohol and the way, as we just talked about here, how this can play out, seems to be a very kind of Western thing, and it could be a kind of sign, if you will, of a very unbalanced psyche that we have so much inherently, you know, in the depths of us that we haven't dealt with, and this is the only way for that to come out as sort of a form of exorcism, if you will.
You may be right. I mean, certainly, Henrik, I would never dismiss any hypothesis, because, as I said, you know, I'm a perennial student, so right. You know, anything that isn't proven is always open to be discussed. I mean, you know, we have to make sure that we retain if you like, the intellectual curiosity to keep exploring every possibility.
Yes.
One of the things that is very interesting to me is that, you know, in the indigenous peoples, they tend not to have any kind of tolerance for alcohol. I mean, let's look at the problems, you know, with the Aborigines, and also with, you know, with those from those who come out of, you know, the Central and Southern American jungles. You know, if we look at the descendants of the Maya and the Aztec, and we look at the descendants of, you know, some of the tribes from the Amazon, you know, these people, they find it very difficult to integrate into society. Because there's, you know, obviously no readiness to integrate from, you know, the colonizers. But the other thing is that, you know, they have zero tolerance for alcohol.
Mm.
So, you know, when they are drinking, you know, perhaps they open themselves up almost immediately.
Could be, yeah, definitely. You know, I do want to ask you a little bit about the idea as well of when going into a lot of this research, as we've been talking about here before, that I at least always held the idea that a spiritual awakening, if you will, needs to go hand in hand with the awakening of the world conspiracy of you know, what really is going on in the world and all the stuff that's been hidden for you for so long. And I've always maintained that people who cannot find the balance of also, you know, this must not perhaps go hand in hand, as it were, but just, you know, it needs to be back to back, if you will, a few, you know, months, years down the road after looking at a lot of conspiracy research material. One needs to focus a little bit more about the spiritual side to all of this in order to maintain that balance within oneself. What do you think about that, Ian?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think, you know, for different people, one triggers the other. You know, there's no right or wrong order. I mean, for some people, if you like, they start the spiritual journey first and they investigate the spiritual experience and integrate the spiritual experience. And then when they return and they focus on, you know, what's going on in the political arena, all of a sudden, they see things through a completely different lens.
Yes,
and it's, you know, it's almost like, you know, my God, you know, I now can actually see the connectivity of these things. And then again, I mean, that gives them obviously another problem. You know, what do you do with it? Because nobody believes it. And this is why, I mean, I have said this in a number of presentations. Consider the possibility that, you know, those who actually we perceive as driving this increasingly negative agenda, those who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers of this global fiefdom, you know, let's use the umbrella term, those who perceive themselves to be an integral part of the New World Order.
Yes.
They may be doing us being humanity, they may be doing us a massive favor. Because what they're actually doing in their arrogance and their overt, increasingly overt aggression is giving us an opportunity, you know, to see through the veneer and the bullshit. You know, whereas 30, 40 years ago, it was, you know, much more clandestine. There was greater obfuscation. It was much more difficult to probe through. There were people probing through. Mm. I mean, Rudolf Steiner, you know, if you look at a lot of what he was saying during the course of his lectures, he was sort of exposing the machinations. I mean, there was a series of lectures that he gave in 1916 and 17 called The Karma of Untruthfulness. Mm-hmm. And those series of lectures were focusing on the lies and the manipulations of governments to achieve particular ends. And of course, at that time, he was focusing on the events of the First World War, and also, interestingly, the events that led up to the Balfour Agreement, which, of course, was the formation of an Israeli or Jewish homeland.
Yes, yes.
So there's always been people who have been trying to raise awareness of it, but there hasn't necessarily been a big audience. But now what's happening is that, you know, these people are becoming so outrageously arrogant. And I think that they are trying to sort of show that actually it doesn't matter how many people see what they're doing, they can still get away with it. Well, our job is to ultimately show that that ain't the case. And I think, as Neil Kramer said, you know, it might not be the 100th monkey, it might not be the 100,000th monkey, it might be the 1,000,000th monkey, but, you know, more and more and more people are starting to see through the charade that is presented in the political arena. I mean, even this last incident where, of course, the U.S. baited the Russians effectively to launch a new Cold War. I mean, all the Western media has been saying that the Russians invaded South Ossetia. But, you know, I haven't yet spoken to anybody who is taking the media story at face value. Because people have seen the evidence for themselves. They know the Americans had military advisors in Georgia immediately before Saakashvili launched the attack on South Ossetia. And, you know, the Russians, because South Ossetia is a Russian enclave, the Russians went in there to defend their people. The Russians didn't go in there to invade Georgia. The Russians went in to defend the Russian enclave of South Ossetia.
Yes,
but the Americans obviously have tried to use it to launch a new Cold War. Why do they want a new Cold War? Because they need to kickstart their economy, and the only way they perceive they can do that is go back into an arms race. But you know what? People are seeing through it, which is fantastic. So these guys are doing us a favor. So, you know, we have to, I think, actually sort of put things in perspective. And, you know, if it wasn't for the outrageous behavior of these guys, it would actually be more difficult for us to, you know, to be able to demonstrate, you know, what's occurring.
Yes. And that's a very important point, you know, that the New World Order is doing us in that regard a favor. And I'm talking here on another level, that they represent a challenge to us, that we shouldn't be taken down by the propaganda. We shouldn't be, you know, scared into submission by all the, you know, lies and garbage that they throw out there. And when we do that, when we take that, you know, stance, so to speak, against that, a psychological stance and an agreement with oneself that no, this is crap, I mean, I'm moving away from that, I'm not looking at that anymore, it's a terrible, you know, one gets terrible strength out of that. You know, it's an incredible and important moment, I think, in one's life. And these guys here at the top, they really represent that challenge in a way. And to look only at the geopolitics of this, so to speak, to only look at that aspect and be, you know, frightened to death and you know, looking at how many, you know, nukes they're planning to drop now on be it Iran or whatever, and what Cheney's up to, you know, and only looking at that, I feel that that's definitely an important step. We always need to, you know, keep an eye on that, what these guys are up to, what they're doing and so forth. But I feel that there's another level to this as well. And even the fact that we're just being so immersed in what it is that these people are doing all the time, that we tend to forget our own lives and even what we are all about, that's a very, that's a negative side to all of this. What do you think, Ian?
I think you're absolutely right. And again, it is absolutely keeping it in balance. But I think, you know, the realization of what's occurring on the bigger arena can actually, you know, trigger that reflection, because if you actually take a pace back and you go, my God, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
And then we actually start to question. I mean, and I think obviously, you know, the spiritual journey is kicked off when eventually we ask ourselves the question, what is the purpose of this third dimensional existence? Yes. You know, because everything about our education and mind brainwashing in the Western world is based on, you know, religious orthodoxy of birth, life, death, period.
Mm.
Period. You know, now let me tell you, I mean, you know, one of the things I'm absolutely convinced of, to the point of almost being arrogant and say it's a knowledge, is that I don't know how many lifetimes it is that, you know, it's taken me to get to what I'm doing today. I'm certainly prepared to acknowledge that it's you know, quite a few. But one of the things I absolutely and unequivocally accept is that everything I've ever done in the past was simply preparation for what I'm doing now.
Mm.
And everything I'm doing now is simply preparation for whatever it is I'm going to do in the future. And that's the way it's always going to be, you know, because this is a perennial journey. There is always something to learn. It doesn't matter where you're at. There's always something to learn. I mean, you know, the extreme opposite of that is that, you know, back at the end of the 19th century, there was a U.S. senator who actually tabled the motion that the patents office in the U.S. should be closed down. Hmm. Why did he table that motion? Because he said that everything that could ever be invented has now been invented.
Oh, yeah, I heard that one. That's incredible.
It's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, that is the classic example of intellectual idiocy and arrogance.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and of course, I mean, the same level of arrogance is when you hear people say that humanity is the peak of creation. Oh, my God, give me a break. If this is the peak, you know, we're in a real mess.
We are.
We're so far down the food chain that, you know, people have no idea. But, you know, that's part of our journey. And it is a journey. And I mean, it's a classic adage that it's not the destination that's important. It's the journey.
Yeah.
You know, I heard this put very succinctly. And, you know, the guy I actually heard explain this didn't realize I was listening into his conversation. But, you know, this is a number of years ago now, and I was getting a bit impatient. You know, I wanted the next step. I mean, I felt I was ready for, you know, the next step, whatever that might be.
Mm-hmm.
And I was gifted by the universe to overhear this conversation. And wouldn't it be ironic if the guy that I was listening to was listening into the program? I have no idea who he was, mm-hmm. but I was sitting in a cafe, and I know what he was. He was a lecturer at the Schumacher College in Sussex. And I was sitting behind him, and I had literally thrown this question out to the universe sort of, you know, the day before. And there I am. And one of his students said to him, you know, Professor, I think that, you know, we should accelerate the pace of this course. And what he said was, look, let me give you this analogy. He said, it's like taking a trip. You've got to go to, say, Edinburgh. So you've got to travel from London to Edinburgh. It's a journey of 400 miles. He said, you can get there very quickly. You can go by plane. But what have you got out of the journey? You know, you've been through the usual hassle of airport staff. You've probably got some frustration. You've flown. You've got to your destination and you're there in an hour.
Mm.
Alternatively, you can go by donkey. It might take you a bit longer, but which of those paths do you think will give you the most insight?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's like Satish Kumar. I mean, you know, Satish Kumar, who's the founder of the Resurgence magazine. And of course, you know, when he was a young monk, he took a trip from India, and he visited, I think, Moscow, London, and New York, and with no money at all. Now, he could have flown. But his tutor, his mentor, said, no, Satish, you know, you need to do this journey and demonstrate, you know, your faith, and you need to start this journey with no money. And I mean, the stories that he tells and the people that he came across, it's like everything was scripted, which, of course, it probably was, you know, but not on this realm. And, you know, obviously that. In experience, I mean, set Satish up for everything that, you know, he does today and the wonderful work that that he does today. And, you know, so I absolutely concur with what you're saying, Henrik. I think the, you know, the spiritual journey is an integral part of this. In fact, is the primary part of this.
Yeah.
I mean, the geopolitical stuff actually is just, you know, almost dealing with the symptoms. You know, the real journey, without any shadow of doubt, is the spiritual realm. But let me add something here, because, you know, one of the things that I come across quite a lot is, you know, various spiritual groups, and because they know of the work that I do in trying to expose the excesses of, you know, the geopolitical agenda, and their attitude is, oh, you know, we don't need to go there.
Yeah, well,
no,
there you go. Yeah.
You know, it's all done. I mean, we've just got to actually sit tight until 2012, and then it's all going to change.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let me just sort of cast this as an observation. One of the things I think we can all agree on is that we are contributing to our future in our thought process.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think we understand that. I mean, you know, we many people actually have reached the point where, you know, they know very, very well that, you know, it is their thinking that actually creates their reality in one way, shape or form.
Yes.
And here we are with an opportunity to create a collective reality, a reality that we would like to see, you know, beyond 2012. And one of the things that is fascinating for me is that remote viewers apparently cannot see beyond this veil.
So I've heard. Yeah, so I've heard. You know,
it gives me reason to think that it's still being written, it's still being created. So for those people who are sitting back and just sort of waiting for all this to happen, consider the possibility that in taking that action or inaction, what you're actually sanctioning is the current geopolitical agenda.
Hmm.
Alternatively, you know, I don't have any existential commitment to a particular outcome, but, you know, what I do know is that the excesses and the inhumanity that is practiced by those who believe that they are the rightful rulers of this global fiefdom is totally unacceptable to me today and very definitely for the future.
Yeah.
And consequently, you know, in whatever little way I can, and there's many, many other people obviously doing much the same, you know, we will do whatever we can and will continue to do whatever we can to try and raise this awareness and encourage people to participate in this process.
Of course.
Because otherwise, what they're going to do is just sanction more of the same.
Yeah, exactly. This is about raising the awareness so people can start making these choices, you know, for themselves in order to be aware of it, what is going on and so forth. And again, when one do that, they're no longer in the hands of someone else that is controlling their lives, you know, and at that point everyone, you know, could think differently of where we should be going or where they individually should be going and so forth. But at least the scenario we have in front of us right now is that people are so dumbed down and so incredibly, you know, inundated with propaganda, as it were, so they not even be able to reach up to the level where they get in contact with themselves to understand their own processes, and that they are being, you know, lulled into this state of ignorance, you know, and that needs to be overcome. And when that point is reached, you know, then we can discuss, you know, where we should be going or whatever. But I agree with you. Yeah, definitely.
Well, Henrik, I think from listening to you in the past, I think you are a student of Gurdjieff. And, you know, what? Just to pick up on a piece of Gurdjieff, and by the way, I will say that I am a great student of early 20th century Russian philosophy. One of the reasons I like that period is because it's completely unadulterated. It's not conditioned by movies and television. You know, I mean, it was philosophy that was established the hard way, if you like, by going within.
Yes.
But Gurdjieff made his observation. You know, he said, look, you know, as we go through this journey and as we enter into the spiritual part of this journey, you know, there's the way of the fakir, there's the way of the yogi, and there's the way of the monk. And in each of those cases, the journey is actually quite selfish. And in particular, he focused on the way of the monk because, you know, the monk can completely sort of disassociate himself from, you know, the rest of the world. He can go and live in a monastery. He can go and do his sort of, you know, chants five times a day or whatever. All he has to do is contribute to the work of the community. He knows he's going to get fed, get water, get a bed, you know, and he can sort of hang out there until he leaves this mortal realm.
Mm.
But Gurdjieff said, you know, there's also the fourth way. And the fourth way it is about going through that experience. So by all means, you know, go the way of the yogi, go the way of the fakir, go the way of the monk. But when you've gone through the process, it's really important to bring yourself out and work out how that's going to be, or how you can apply your knowledge in the wider realm. And I think, you know, a classic example of this, and this is a guy who doesn't shout about his spirituality, but, you know, for me, Nelson Mandela, who was under arrest for 26 years, but he never lost his faith that he had a purpose. And that 26 years, obviously, spent you know, much of the time going deep within himself, was tremendous preparation. So we never know, you know, when the time will be when we can actually make that contribution out into the wider realm. But I don't think many people would argue that Nelson Mandela has been a major contributor to the political process over the last decade or so. You know? And it was the 26 years of house arrest that probably prepared him to do that.
Yeah, definitely. I know that there are, you know, ideas about him and his background and so forth. But as you say, no one could argue that he has been, you know, a big part of it. Definitely. I agree with you there. Yeah.
Just to go back to some of the spiritual aspects, though, for a second, Henrik.
Yes.
There's a couple of, I think, an important message. One was a quote I came across a little while ago, which is actually from Parsifal. And the quote is here. It's the student meeting with his master, and he says, "You say you yearn for the grail, you foolish man. I am grieved to hear that, for no man can ever win the grail unless he is known in heaven and called by name to the grail." You know, and I think that's a very interesting telling and telling remark, because this is a process that I actually don't think is very easy to kick off yourself. I think that it's almost like there's a timer within the DNA, and so you can do some sort of preparatory work, you know, but there comes a point when something kicks in. It's a bit like, you know, adolescence. I mean, we know puberty and adolescence kick in at 13,
yes,
give or take, and some have said that's starting to happen earlier. And I think it's the same with this awakening. It's a natural process. I think everybody has the opportunity. And it's really a question of, you know, how should I say, being ready to embrace it as and when it arises. And there's one book, if there's one book that I would recommend to people who are going through this process, or are friends or relatives of people who are starting to go through the process. And it's a book that's called Spiritual Emergency. Mm-hmm. Now, it's actually compiled by Stanislav Grof and his wife Christina, and he's changed the phraseology now, because now he uses the term spiritual emergence. But I mean, he pulled this book together you know, with a number of contributors. I mean, another number of his contemporaries, like R.D. Lang, Roberto Assagioli, who of course is the guy behind Psychosynthesis, and Ram Dass. Now, all of these people went through their own spiritual emergency, i.e. it was a time in life where, you know, their whole reality was ripped out from under them and they had to relearn. And they actually became, if you like, a community within California. And and now, I mean, they do some tremendous work in California in helping people, you know, go through this process. Tragically, I'm not aware of a similar type of I'll use the word institution, but you know what I mean. Yes. There's not a type of community available that I'm aware of in Western Europe.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, you mentioned that idea also that this is something that could be something of the, almost in the DNA, if you will, an activation of the DNA. This could be, if one is so inclined to think of this in evolutionary terms, that we as a species potentially are you know, we have been, you know, coming up to this point, so to speak, and at this stage, then something is triggered, if you will, within that has been lying dormant or what have you within the DNA that mainly you know, opens up a new area, a new way of thinking. And again, of course, this has been happening before. There have been, you know, enlightened people, so to speak, that have been walking this planet many thousands of years ago. So this is by no means anything new, but but potentially in the mass scale, if you will, that this potentially could be happening in, and what I think we are seeing right now, then, that this is something that's becoming more and more common. I think that idea is very interesting, that this has to do with the evolution of something really unlocking at this potential time here, at this particular time here. What do you think, Ian? Do you think that could be something that is behind this? And again, that gets us back to the question of the time we're in at this point. So much is speeding up, more information. It's really incredible time to be alive, isn't it, right now?
Oh, without any shadow of doubt. I mean, I wouldn't have missed this for anything. I mean, I am just so glad that I had the opportunity to be here right now. I think you're absolutely on the button here. And if we look at the work of Terence McKenna and his Time Wave Zero, I mean, Terence McKenna knew nothing about 2012 when he put together the Time Wave Zero. And when he was doing this analysis of the evolution of consciousness, he came up with this end date. And I think, if I'm speaking from the top of my head here, but I got a feeling that his end date was November the 17th, 2012. And what he actually identified was that man's consciousness would sort of expand, if you like, on an exponential basis. And something like, 90% of this evolutionary process would occur in the last 17 seconds, I mean, it was a very, very interesting hypothesis. And then after he'd put that together, that was when he came across the whole 2012 phenomena. And of course, what he acknowledged was that he had done his work independently, but on the basis that he was just 5 weeks out from his end date of the Time Wave Zero to the end date of the Mayan calendar, I mean, he realized that there was obviously some relationship here.
Yes.
And one of the things I think I might have mentioned this before, but what we should also acknowledge is that this 2012 phenomenon, and I think many of us are aware that something is going to happen. Anybody who tells you they know for sure is delusional.
Yeah, I agree.
And our challenge is to prepare ourselves. I mean, think of what we were talking about earlier with the person who is not ready for the shamanic experience. I think we're sort of getting into something like that. We've actually got to prepare ourselves for something that is way outside the bounds of our current perception. And that in itself may be what determines, who goes through and who doesn't, for example.
Sure.
And I also have this sort of vision that every time we come up with what we think is going to happen at 11:11 on December 21st, 2012, the celestial scriptwriters go, oh, shit, that's another one off the list. Because their challenge is to come up with something that none of us have thought of.
There you go.
So I absolutely concur with you that, something is occurring here. It's been occurring. The process got this kickstart with the publication of Jose Arguelles' book, The Mayan Factor.
Yeah.
Because, it doesn't matter what anybody tells you, until that book was published, 2012 was not in the public consciousness. Okay, now, there's another researcher, Jeff Stray, who, in my opinion, is probably one of the primary researchers into the 2012 phenomena. He's the webmaster of diagnosis2012.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
He's the author of the book Beyond 2012, Catastrophe or Ecstasy. And Jeff has spent probably the best part of nearly 20 years compiling anything and everything from all around the world, from folklore, from mythology, from near-death experiences, from out-of-body experiences, but anything that relates to 2012 and compiling it very objectively without passing sort of opinion. So anybody that is interested in looking at the depth and breadth of the 2012 phenomena should definitely go and take a look at Jeff's website, but be prepared to be there for a few days.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information there.
There is.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal website. He's actually just published a pocket version of his book called 2012 In Your Pocket. But no, I mean, Jeff Stray's work is absolutely essential to any researcher who is seriously interested in the 2012 phenomena. So here we are. Jose Arguelles publishes this book in 1987. So effectively creating a 25-year window to provide humanity, with an opportunity to prepare for 2012. Now, you say, but you know, I'm sure people knew about it before that date. Well, if anybody can come up with any reference to December 21st, 2012, as having any significance before 1987, before the publication of Jose Arguelles' book, both Jeff and I would like to hear from them. Hmm. What we do acknowledge is that there was certainly some awareness amongst Mayanists, and not least, of course, Eric Thompson, of the Mayan calendar, but they weren't looking at this sort of, you know, spiritual aspect, which an evolutionary aspect, which Arguelles introduced. So, and I mean, I've done some other presentations in the past where I've looked at how this ancient knowledge has been returned to us over the last 200 years. I mean, we can identify when the Dark Ages started. I mean, basically, it was October of 312 AD at the Battle of the Milky Bridge.
Right.
You know, that was the start of Dark Ages, because obviously that was the point at which Constantine committed to make Christianity the orthodox religion of the Roman Empire. You know, less than 100 years later, in 415, we had the destruction of the Alexander Library. And then, you know, for the last 1600 years, you know, the Orthodox Christian religion has systematically destroyed all reference to ancient knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah.
Obviously, when they went over to Central and South America, there was all the destruction there led by Bishop Diego de Landa. If anybody had any insights, you know, basically they were burned at the stake as heretics. But with the interpretation of the deciphering of the Egyptian hieroglyphs by Jean-François Champollion in 1820. And very interestingly, Champollion told his parents in 1797 that he had come here to decipher the Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was 7 years old at the time. And it was very interesting because that was 2 years before the Rosetta Stone was discovered.
Ah, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, the Rosetta Stone was the catalyst. The Rosetta Stone was found or returned to us in 1799. And then by 1820, Champollion had effectively done his work. He died a young man. I mean, he died, I think, at the age of 40 or so. But he'd done his work. And so it was the deciphering of the hieroglyphs that started the process of returning ancient knowledge and ancient wisdom to us. And then, of course, you know, we go through, we have the deciphering of other scripts. We have the return of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi Scrolls. You know, it's only in 1975, thanks to the work of Tatiana Puskuryakov,
yes,
that actually we're able to read the Mayan glyphs now.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, there's still other glyphs, other languages. Easter Island's a classic example that, of course, we can't yet interpret. But I'm sure, you know, at the right time, that information will be returned to us.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we are at a very, very exciting juncture in the evolutionary process. I think the important thing is that, you know, none of us have or establish any existential commitment to a particular outcome.
No, exactly. And you know, following up on the idea of change or the anticipation of change, I heard Robert Anton Wilson talking a little bit about the Renaissance period and how, you know, people at that time were talking about change as well, or that was kind of in the environment of the time, you know, that something new is you know, bound to happen, that it's something in the environment, almost something in the atmosphere, and that feeds kind of into the system as well, that feeds into the creation and the universe, so to speak, is responding to that, meaning that even if the 2012 phenomena in itself actually isn't anything, what has happened at this point is because it's creating such a phenomena, and it could be good or bad, we can deal with that later on. I mean, there's two featured movies, like one by Michael Bay and another guy is coming out later, I think next year or something like that. And that's really going to, depending on how they treat it, so of course, it's probably going to be garbage, these movies. But anyway, it's going to launch that into the mindset of many more people at that point. And what I'm thinking possibly is happening here as well is that this anticipation of something is feeding into the system itself. And if we consider such things as quantum theory, we know that by the art of observation and intent of what we're looking at, that this is something that's going to produce results as well, meaning that when we look towards this date as change or something of immense importance, I think that will feed into it so much that will actually create the phenomena in itself, if you follow my train of thought, Ian. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. And I go just picking up on both points. I think the Renaissance, of course, which of course means rebirth anyway, the Renaissance was absolutely an integral part of, you know, kicking this whole process off. And of course, let's not forget that what started the Renaissance was the reawakening of the interest in the Egyptian religion. And of course, we shouldn't forget that Giordano Bruno, and I love this irony. I love this irony, which will come remind me if I forget about it. But Giordano Bruno, of course, you know, probably one of the greatest philosophers, also known as the forgotten philosopher. But he came very, very close to convincing Elizabeth I to effectively adopt Hermeticism and the Egyptian belief system as the official religion of England. And of course, I mean, she was persuaded that that wasn't a good idea by her Protestant advisors.
Sure.
But of course, Giordano Bruno is Gordon Brown in Italian.
Really? No.
Yeah. What an irony. I mean, the last epithet that I'm going to associate with Gordon Brown is one of a great philosopher.
Oh, jeez. Oh, my God.
But yeah, I mean, there's no question that, and once again, of course, anybody who's seriously interested in looking at this, how this whole process has unfolded, should, of course, look at the role of the Medicis and Giordano Bruno. Yes. And, you know, sort of bringing this back into the sort of wider consciousness. You know, because here we are some, 500 years later, 400 or 500 years later, now perhaps starting to reap the benefit of that. And absolutely concur with you in terms of even if nothing happens. And we have to say that's one possibility because, you know, once again, all of those people who have got an existential commitment to something mega happening at 11/11, December 21st, 2012, I mean, what we may see, if nothing happens, what we may see is a whole bunch of people just die. Just because, you know, basically they're so disappointed. And, you know, basically they see no point in continuing with a sort of physical incarnation because everything they thought they came here for hasn't happened. But, you know, one possibility is that 11/11 on December 21st, 2012 is the fulcrum. And it's just a fulcrum where the balance tips. And, you know, whereas... you know, the those people, that small group of people who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers of this global fiefdom, you know, suddenly find that they are no longer in the ascendancy and that they're losing control and that, you know, there is a more humane political philosophy that's starting to take over.
Right.
I mean, as you know, I mean, you know, one of the presentations that that I have given is that, you know, these people believe that they are the descendants of the Nephilim.
Yes.
And, you know, because of, I mean, this is really what I discussed in the presentation that Rick came to see back last year, you know, where I was, you know, hypothesizing that these guys are actually very, very scared about what might occur on December 21st, 2012, because it may be an event that actually removes them en bloc, call it the rapture if you like, but it may be an event that removes them en bloc from this physical arena, this third dimensional arena. Now, just consider that for a moment, you know, because this world has been dominated for certainly probably 5,500 years by generally people who do not have humanity's interests at heart.
Yeah.
They have effectively treated humanity as a slave race. Well, consider the possibility that if that group, that whole meme, that mindset was removed from the planet, and it gave humanity an opportunity to evolve spiritually, emotionally, intellectually, without that kind of negative interference, then it opens up a whole new ballgame.
Oh, indeed. Oh, yeah, definitely. It's just, you know, that idea that it feels like we need to, you know, in a way then take the control of the situation, take back, you know, the control of our own lives here. And yep. to have an external force like that just remove a difficult obstacle or something like the elite of this planet, that would actually be quite disappointing to me in one way. I mean, obviously, it would be, I would welcome it on one level, absolutely, obviously. But on another level, it's like, I don't know, should things be that easy, you know, if you follow me? It should be, I mean, we should really have to also really take back this and make something out of this and really, you know, prove that we're able to run our own show here, so to speak, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
hey, listen, like I said, you know, it's a question of staying totally open. You know, all possibilities are on the table.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it comes back, I guess, to the point I was making earlier, that, you know, now is not the time to sit back and just say, hey, I'm just going to basically sit on the beach or stay on the golf course until 2012. And then, you know, that's my cue to come on stage.
Mm.
You know, there's a role to play right now. I mean, I absolutely and fundamentally believe that, regardless of whatever outcome is, we do have a responsibility to demonstrate that, you know, we will not tolerate this inhumanity, this what is presented as man's inhumanity to man. Mm. I don't believe it is man's inhumanity to man. I mean, I believe that these guys are not of our race, you know. Mm. And by the way, neither do they. That's why they treat humanity the way they do,
mm.
you know, as expendables, as collateral, whatever other term they come up with.
Right.
You know, I mean, one of the things I learned from working in the international oil field, you know, working across different countries with different cultures, you know, is that basically man is fundamentally mutually supportive, cooperative, respectful. We respect each other's, you know, different philosophies, different religions, you know, and we can live and work together and maximize the skills that each individual and each nation, you know, brings to the table.
Mm.
You know, and yet unfortunately there are those currently in sort of quite important roles in this planet who have completely different ideas about how they will abuse humanity, how they will drive wedges through humanity, how they will maintain conflict between humanity. And yet, you know what, I've never come across any individual that actually on an individual level buys into that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's a very interesting observation, and I definitely agree with you that you know that they lack the appropriate, you know, properties that would define as we know it a human being. So there's definitely something lacking there, and this could be, I mean, we could talk about entities that have, you know, walked in, taken over these people. They might have been of an ancient genetically engineered bloodline that is off planet. We don't know at this point, and I'm just as you, Ian, are just leaving all the tables open on the table here, and just, you know, willing to look at it all wherever it might lead. I'm not afraid of looking into it or something like that. This is far much more, you know, much too interesting to leave something to the side here, you know.
Absolutely, and I guess we've come almost full circle here, because, you know, I mean, I hope that what we, in the way in which we discuss these issues, Henrik, I mean, I hope what, you know, we have been able to demonstrate is that, you know, there is something exciting beyond the fear,
yeah,
beyond the anger. I mean, I don't do this because I'm angry, you know, I don't do it because I'm frightened. In fact, you know, anything but, I do it because I've come through a process. I've had insights that I still don't know how to present. I still don't know how they necessarily fit into the bigger picture. And consequently, I won't be presenting them until I am aware of how they fit into a picture.
Yeah.
But you know, this is a wonderful process. And you know, I'm very fortunate that I have people around me who I can bounce ideas off, who will give me ideas, who will stimulate the thought process. You know, and it'll often go in directions one day that I hadn't even considered the previous day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, as we started off this discussion, you know, unfortunately, obviously, one of our fellow researchers wasn't able to see through the process.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, the other thing we have to take into account is maybe that's what Rick came here to do.
Possibly, yeah.
I wouldn't be having this discussion with you tonight if it wasn't for the work that Rick Clay had done, and if it wasn't for Rick leaving this physical realm right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't know, we cannot know, whilst we're locked into this physical realm, you know, how all these things interplay. One of the things that I do know is that when I cross back over, I'm going to seek out Rick Clay. I'm going to shake his hand, congratulate him on the work that he did in the short time that he was here, and make it very clear that I think that the work he did was instrumental in taking us a few steps forward.
Very good, Ian. I think that's a beautiful point, actually, to begin to round things up here for this time. And I want to thank you, of course, for being with the program on the program with us, Ian. And it was great talking with you about this and getting some of the information out, you know, of what we know so far, and also just go over this a little bit and kind of keep it as a mental image and pondering upon this idea a little bit. What can we learn from this and how do we move on and so forth? So that's very good. I do want to round things up here with you, Ian, mentioning a few of your websites so people can search out a little bit more of some of the work and research that you are doing. I also want to just mention briefly that you'll be coming to Sweden in November. Just tell us briefly about that and where you will be going, if you know that at this point.
Okay, thanks for that, Henrik. Yeah, yes, I mean, as many of your listeners will know, I have been focusing on a thing called Codex Alimentarius for the last 12 months, in amongst all of the other stuff that I do. But Codex Alimentarius is without any shadow of doubt the most outrageous attempt to wipe out organic and natural farming on a global basis, and also to destroy the complementary and natural health industry. I mean, these are subjects that I touch on in a more depth in my latest DVD, which is called The War on Terror, The New World Order Agenda Exposed. And that's going to be released on September the 30th. And you can take a look at it and pre-order it on my website, which is www.ianrcrane.co.uk. More and more people actually are realizing now the detriment that Codex will bring to our lifestyle, because we'll be forced to eat junk food, basically. We're going to be forced to eat GM foods if the biotech industry gets its way. And, of course, that plays perfectly into the hands of the pharmaceutical industry, who will be right there to offer us the drugs that we need to counter the illnesses that we get because of a poor diet. A talk that I gave last year is actually up on YouTube, and it's on Google. It's also available as a DVD from my website. But if you Google Codex Alimentarius or Codex Ian Crane, then you'll see the video there. And I'm coming over to Sweden at the end of November. I think I'm giving three talks, one in Stockholm, one in, is it Örebro?
Örebro, yes.
Örebro, yeah. And the other one is Gothenburg,
yes.
In the last week of November, and for more details, take a look on my website. And obviously, I'm hoping to meet up with you guys and have another conversation with you, perhaps more about the specifics of Codex.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We're definitely looking forward to that. And we will have more details as well available on our website, linked up or something like that. So people that are within this region, Scandinavia or something like that, that are interested in coming and seeing some of your lectures, depending where they're at, can do so. Definitely, that's going to be very interesting. So again, the website is enrcrane.co.uk. That's the main website. Go there, check out some of Ian's great DVDs and some of his products and some of his research that he has up there for you. So with that, let's begin here to round things up. Thank you, Ian, very much again for coming on. Thanks to you out there for listening. And our thanks, of course, to Fredrik behind the controls. Until next time, take care, and we'll see you online.